it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Bryn Lucas, and you're listening to the Autosport F1 Podcast. Well, you know what they say, all good things in life come in threes. And that was certainly the case for Red Bull in Japan as Max Verstappen took his third win in 2024 and in dominant fashion. It was his third straight win in Japan and teammate Sergio Perez followed Max home for a third Red Bull 1-2 finish of the year. So here's a rundown of the result. As we say, Max and Sergio coming home first and second, then the Ferraris of Carlos Sainz and Charles Leclerc gaining four places up on his qualifying position. Lando Norris finished fifth, then it was Fernando Alonso and the Aston Martin in sixth. Russell for Mercedes in 7, Piastri in 8, yes, Lewis Hamilton way down in 9th for the Mercedes, and Yuki Tsunoda scoring that valuable point in front of his home fans. A great result for him. Hülkenberg, Lance Stroll, Magnussen, Bottas, Ocon and Gasly in 15th and 16th, then Sargeant bringing it home in 17th and last place. The final three drivers, Zhou Guanyu, Daniel Ricciardo and Alex Albon, were all DNFs. So joining me now to make sense of all the action, Philip Clearen and Jake Boxall-Legg, a.k.a. JBL. We also have to put that in, don't we? Gentlemen, how are you doing, JBL?
Very good, thank you. As you can see, Brent, I'm currently wearing my Yeovil shirt. Now, Yeovil lost last night, but one more game, and I think we're about to win the National League South if we can just like not concede a goal. So I'm sort of feeling okay. I'm feeling relatively fresh. Race was very sort of tactical, very strategic. So I'm just sort of like on a little bit of a, be nice to sort of have a chill chat about everything that happened.
I'm an Aldershot Town fan, so we're probably not going to make the playoffs trying to get out of the National League proper. So hopefully we'll see you in the National League next year. Phil, I don't think you support an English National League team, do you?
I actually support Southampton, would you believe? Because I studied there for a little bit. So not quite National League, but it's looking a little bit tough now to go up. But anyway.
Hey, play your cards right. Play your cards right. Southampton will be in the National League before you even know it. So there we go. That's our non-F1-based chat out the way. Let's talk about this Grand Prix we've all just witnessed. Max Verstappen took another comfortable victory in the end. That's his 20th in the last 22 races. It's a familiar line, familiar conversation point, but JBL, just how easy was it for Red Bull out there?
I think it wasn't, let's say, as clear-cut as it was in maybe a few other races. Ferrari was a lot closer than it was last year. Carlos Sainz is only 20 seconds off of Verstappen. I don't believe that Verstappen was really pushing it in this race because tyre degradation was such a mitigating factor. I think it was something that towards the end, you know, they very much had a grasp on. But it wasn't his most vintage display, but it was just a sort of relatively easy Sunday afternoon drive. He was driving within himself because he didn't really need to push anymore. There was no point. So yeah, it wasn't an absolute barnstormer from Verstappen by any stretch, but it was just a really good solid drive. Did everything he needed to do, and he got the win. And shout out to Sergio Perez as well for actually being doing a proper support driver job after Melbourne last weekend, where Verstappen retired and he wasn't there to pick up the pieces. So yeah, really good race from them both. Again, nothing special, but you know, sometimes you don't need to do anything special.
Yeah, the only drama that was there was, you know, Max and his race engineer debating over whether he needed two fewer clicks of front ring or not, which they disagreed about, and that was sort of the only thing that you know, represent any sort of drama for Red Bull today. So that tells you a lot. Yeah, it's a little bit depressing that JBL, as you say, the gap to Sainz was only 20 seconds. It's still quite a chasm for me, but yeah, it does show that Ferrari have made a lot of progress compared to last year, but still plain sailing on, certainly on a circuit like this, we, you know, lots of high speed stuff that Red Bull is just untouchable.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get moving away from Red Bull too quickly, but we find it very hard, don't we, to find new things to say about Red Bull. They're so dominant, they're so strong. Max's drive is fantastic as always. Sergio did a good job this weekend, and that's the only thing we ever really talk about, isn't it? How well Sergio Perez has done comparatively to Max Verstappen, who's likely to win. But if there's anyone that's going to really impact them, it's the Ferrari, and it's not the car driven by the guy who is staying next year. It's Carlos Sainz, who got his third podium of 2024. Leclerc coming back, gained four places from his qualifying position on a one-stop strategy. But is there any doubt really remaining, Philip, that I'm going for your formal name now, Phil, Philip, that that Ferrari are the second team?
It's very formal now, yeah. You're my uncle now. no, there's really no doubt. I don't think there has been across the first four races of the season. We've had a variety of circuits, all very different content, low speed, high speed, street circuit, whatever you want, rough tarmac, soft tarmac. And it's clear that Ferrari is the second force, which speaks volumes about how much they have improved their woes from last year, whether it's their tire management, whether it's their just their general consistency in the race, their susceptibility to changing conditions and winds and what have you. And it is interesting to see the way Carlos performs. I mean, he keeps saying that, you know, he doesn't need to prove himself. Everybody up and down the paddock knows what he can do. And he's absolutely correct. But it does seem like since he lost his job, he's like driving like a man possessed at the moment. He's just, yeah, performing at his absolute peak. And I'm, you know, really interested to see, you know, if that is, you're going to sway any opinions of other team bosses in terms of whether they will try and snap him up. But at the same time, I think also, you know, it all comes down to qualifying as well, because Charles didn't have the best qualifying, starting outside the top six. But then if you look at what the difference was, it was only like what, a tenth and a half that covered the entire sort of top six behind Red Bull, at least. So it's not like suddenly Charles is nowhere, but if you qualify poorly with such a tired grid, then it's just really hard to move up. Even if you tried to win a one stop, that almost worked.
I think Leclerc needs to sort of be a little bit more commended for his race, because yeah, qualifying wasn't very good, and that's largely just because there was such a sort of fine margin with regards to tire preparation over the lap. Leclerc wasn't able to quite hit that, and Sainz can kind of hit it a little bit more. But turning around that one-stop strategy, that was a really, really strong effort from Leclerc. His stint on the medium tyres was super consistent. I think I've got the times up in front of me somewhere. But yeah, he was just able to rattle off a series of laps in the 137s, sort of 138s every now and again. Just keeping those tyres in, not taking too much out of them. And then when it came to the point where he needed to pit, he stayed out. Norris was catching him. He managed to stay out, go in ahead, come out ahead. And that really made it for him, because Norris, up until that point, was looking like a potential podium contender. So for Leclerc to kind of turn that around, that was a really, really strong effort. And I think he should get a little bit more plaudit for it, because it wasn't the optimal strategy. It wasn't really the fastest strategy. I think Sainz had that. And yes, as Phil said, Sainz has been driving out of his skin lately. Seems to have really just taken a liking to this new car. Seems to be a lot more balanced. He seems to be able to kind of do what he wants to do with it without having to think about it too much. And that's giving him a little bit more mental latitude to kind of, let's say, optimize and work on the strategies that Ferrari's giving him and that he's giving feedback on. It's sort of very much a kind of two-way thing with Sainz. He's really, really good at calling the shots when he's out on track. So I think both Ferrari drivers have done a really, really good job today. They weren't going to have the pace to beat the Red Bulls. It wasn't a race where, like Australia, where there was quite a lot of tire graining. It was just a sort of standard relatively high tyre deg race. Ferrari's worked on that significantly over the winter, and their degradation relative to Red Bull is so much better now. But it's just out and out pace that Ferrari's lacking a little bit compared to Red Bull. I think, you know, maybe about 0.4 a lap. So if they can find a little bit more downforce without ruining all the good work they've done on their tyre deg, they'll be in a really good place.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at Carlos Sainz, though, for a moment, he's just out driving his teammate. I know you say Charles did a good job today, and he certainly did. But Carlos Sainz, the three Grand Prix that he's taken part in, because he had that operation, didn't he, at Saudi Arabia, he's been on the podium every single time. Charles Leclerc has had two out of those four races. So when you look at the shop window, Carlos Sainz is making his argument, or the argument for him to be in a seat, any seat next year, compelling, especially when you look further down the line and you've got Daniel Ricciardo, who was one of those drivers that you think, okay, he might be one that will go and step in here or step in there. And there is Carlos Sainz saying, hang on a minute, don't forget me. And it's a tough one, isn't it? We'll come to Daniel Ricciardo, I'm sure, in a bit. But Phil, your thoughts on this Carlos Sainz situation and just where he can go? It seems like he could just pick a team at the moment.
Yeah, it's intriguing. You have to go back to what Christian Horner said in Australia when he was asked about Yuki Tsunoda and his prospects of graduating. And he turned the question into one about Carlos Sainz, just unprompted. And, you know, it's interesting, isn't it, what they're going to do? Because they've got a few options Red Bull do, and Sainz has to be one of them now. But, you know, it's like, and this is kind of a good analogy that I came up with during the race, during a boring spell. It was like, you know, it helps that Christian Horner is 50 now, but coincidentally, but it's like imagine you have your midlife crisis and you've got your comfortable family station wagon, but you're just browsing brochures and you see, like, you know, a couple of really interesting looking sports cars are a lot quicker but not quite as comfortable for your family, but you're like quite tempted to go for them. I feel like in this case, Sergio Perez is sort of the station wagon where you know what you're going to get and there's no dramas in the team, but he's not quite the quickest option. So do you go for like the more sports car, Carlos Sainz, Fernando Alonso option, which are, you know, an upgrade, but not quite as, you know, there might be a more exciting, but not quite as comfortable within the team in terms of the dynamics and everything going on. So it's just sort of that question of, is Checo going to be confirming his form that has been very good so far? Let's be clear about that this year. Once Red Bull makes a decision around the summertime, will Checo have been able to confirm that form? Or is it another false start like we saw 2 years ago where he started off really strongly, won two races, and then he just disappeared? So I think Red Bull has the time on its side, but surely they have to be considering Carlos. And then as far as the other teams go, I'm not sure Carlos is necessarily top of the list at Mercedes, I don't believe, because I think they really want Antonelli in the seat as soon as possible. Now, they're not just going to chuck him in the seat unprepared. They're, you know, he's doing testing a week from now, and they're going to give him the time to prepare. But that does mean, say that Antonelli only joins in 1 year or 2 years, you need a backup option that can sort of keep his seat warm. And I just don't think Carlos will be the man to accept that at this stage of his career. So you need somebody that is happy to just be there for one or two seasons. Whereas I think Carlos really wants a long-term commitment somewhere.
It's going to be interesting to see how this one really does play out. And as you mentioned, other drivers that have done very, very well, or certainly not surprisingly, it's Fernando Alonso, isn't he? I mean, he's another driver who's been on the block, around the block, up and down the block. He's been on the block for a very long time. It was another great finish, sixth place for him. I think he described it, JBO, as one of his best ever drives.
It was in his top five, certainly. And I don't... It's always a thing with Fernando that he is incredibly self-aggrandizing, and if he'll do an overtake or something, and it might be sort of like a relatively run-of-the-mill overtake, oh, that's the best overtake I've ever done. But you do have to read between the lines a little bit, and you do need to look at his race, and it was actually, I'm not going to say it as among his top five, but it was generally very, very good, really impressive, especially when you look at the Aston Martin as a package, is clearly the fifth best car on the grid. There is quite a bit of margin to the back five cars. there's not too much of a gap to Mercedes and perhaps to McLaren as well. But it's still generally slower. And Alonso, I think, overperformed what the car realistically was capable of. It's probably like P8, P9 material. So for Alonso to put the race together that he did, soft tyre stint at the start was absolutely vital to that because, you know, it got a good start, made up ground. And then it was able to keep those tyres in as well. It wasn't like he got to lap five and they just died and fell off. He was able to sort of keep pace with everybody else around him. So that put him on a sort of relatively even state of flux with everybody else. Then he went for the medium stint and then the hard stint. I think that was basically, he said after the race, that was the only real option available to him. But at the end as well, just a fantastic bit of gamesmanship. And it was like watching Sainz in Singapore last year. He had Piastri behind him. Russell was homing into view as well. Alonso was like, well, yeah, you can have DRS, Oscar. I don't mind. I'm just going to, you know, use my energy up, recharge through the rest of the lap where it's a lot harder to pass. And then when Piastri started to come under attack from Russell, Alonso was like, right, okay, I'm off now. Bye, guys. Fight it out amongst yourselves. So I thought it was just a really, really brilliant Alonso-ian drive. Really, really strongly thought out. He was kind of driving everybody else's races for them, in a sense, which is when he's at his absolute best. Yeah, massive turnaround from Australia last week. Yeah, really, really good day from him.
Yeah, Fernando seems to think he's had a top five drive every other week. So I think you'll find if there are 12 to 13 races in your top five, you'll find that's a bit of an issue mathematically. But yeah, it does seem like if he's not on the podium, that he's keen to remind people how good he was in case they didn't see it. But yeah, he was brilliant today. And especially after the events of Melbourne with the penalty he got for indirectly causing George Russell's accident, I think it was good to see him defend properly within the rule book, unquestionably. And I don't think I would disagree with him that car is the fifth fastest. It's probably around there. It's not, you know, it's no match for McLaren, and he finished ahead of one, so good job by him.
Fifth fastest, if you don't include Lance Stroll, I think is fair to say. And I was having a think, and JBL, we spoke very briefly about this before we went and started recording this, but keeping Fernando Alonso at Aston Martin, if you want success, you almost need to keep someone like that who's a regular point scorer and a decent point scorer in the team so you can actually develop and move on. With Lance Stroll, and we've talked about this too many times, so I'm not going to dwell on it for too long, but Lance Stroll in that team, not point scoring, it's hampering Aston Martin being able to get on the back of that fourth place in the constructors, and it's worth a lot of money. So I know that the finances and the way it is Aston Martin, but what do we think about this? I mean, is Fernando going to jump ship if Lance Stroll stays? Is it as clear cut as that, JBL?
I don't know if it's as clear cut as that. I do agree that he's costing the team points, and that was the case last year. Aston Martin probably should have beaten McLaren in the Constructors' Championship, but because of Stroll's pretty poor scoring record, and you compare that to Piastri, that was just where they fell down on points, and Alonso sort of carried the team almost single-handedly into that position. To have two drivers, you know, even a driver that's, you know, not quite on Alonso's level, but, you know, let's say somebody like a Perez or an Ocon or a Gasly in that second seat, they would have done it probably quite easily. So for Aston Martin, it's no longer just, it shouldn't just be a Lawrence Stroll vanity project. This should be a genuine team that has genuine ambition to fight for Constructors' Championships. And when you employ a driver that's kind of at odds with that, it's like, you know, what's the game plan here? And I think Alonso sort of has recognised that. I think his ambition is to win his ambition is to win a third and final driver's title, let's say. But he'll recognise the value of a Constructors' Championship. And if the team isn't performing and it's not getting the prize money in, then that has knock-on impact on infrastructure and things like that. It means the team can't quite do as much with its car. So it's a bit of a catch-22. Alonso did say when he first joined the team, you know, Lance Stroll was the future of the team and he wanted to do everything to support him and that kind of thing. But he must, again, I think this is just classic Alonso gamesmanship, trying to sort of curry a little bit of favour so that he can sort of spend his points a little bit later when he's moaning about something. So it's just a difficult situation, isn't it? I don't really, you know, I know that he's the CEO's son, but at what point does a team's performance become more important than familial ties? And I think we've probably long surpassed that point.
Yeah, it all comes down to what's the goal here. And if the goal that Lawrence Stroll has set out is still to be the new Red Bull, let's say, and to produce a car that's so good that it not only wins the championship, but also Lance can be a contender and be a regular race winner, then, you know, as you see with Checo Perez, he's won quite a few races, not as many as he should have, but he won a few races with Red Bull and when it's so dominant. So, you know, if you're trying to emulate that, then that's not necessarily conflicting with Fernando Alonso's ambitions. He also wants to be in the best car. So I don't think he'll worry too much about Lance or about the Constructors' Championship, as long as he sees the drive that he didn't see at Alpine, the drive to really become the best in every single area, and then compete for the World Championship. And 2026 will be the best opportunity for an Aston Martin to do so. And now it's up to Alonso to decide, you know, is Aston still going to be the team to do it? Is there a different opportunity, whether that's at Red Bull or Mercedes? You know, if those options are even there, we still don't know that 100%. It could also be gamesmanship by drivers and by managers to get the, you know, to bring the driver price up, if you will. So I don't think if Fernando thinks Aston has what it takes to become the best team on the grid, then I don't think he'll leave just because it's not scoring all the points with its second driver. I don't think that's really his problem.
Yeah, and as we're alluding to on this a little bit, though, that if you're not scoring the points in the championship as a team collectively, then your appeal to the top designers, that isn't quite so great. So you don't get the very, very best of the very, very best. You're having to go to the B team, but certainly you're having to fish around a bit more for those that you want. Let's move to a driver who's definitely moving. That's Lewis Hamilton. We know he's going to Ferrari in 2025. He spoke of a breakthrough with the Mercedes W15 despite his seventh place start, but it was a difficult race for him, wasn't it, Phil? And it just seems that there's another false dawn for the Brackley team. We've spoken about this and you've written an article about how they seem to struggle in different temperatures and they've kind of got on top of this a little bit, but it just didn't play into their hands.
Yeah, and I think they expected to do better if you look at the temperatures this weekend. But then actually on race day, I think the track was about 14 degrees hotter than it was on Saturday during qualifying. So maybe this is another symptom where they looked pretty okay earlier on in the weekend, but then when the temperatures ramp up, they start struggling again. And that's probably the main hypothesis right now. I don't think it's too early to tell. We're recording the night of the race, so they won't have the answers yet, but they'll have to do some more soul searching and see what's going on. But yeah, it's perfectly possible that during the first stint, when it was really sunny out there, they started just eating up the tires too much. And then I think when it got a lot more cloudy during the second part of the race, they seem to be on the pace again. So it is quite curious. And, you know, so far temperature seems to be the main factor here, at least that we can identify.
Needs to be sorted though, doesn't it? Because, you know, it's all well and good racing in the cold places, but it doesn't happen all that often that they go to a place that's, we're off to Antarctica for the next round of the Grand Prix, the next Grand Prix in the World Championship. So they're going to have to get on top of it. I'm just looking at Lewis Hamilton, his body language and the way he seems. I mean, it's been said he's not looking across the fence. He's not looking over at what's going on at Ferrari, but of course he is. He's going to be having a look, isn't he? He's going to be intrigued and be probably wishing he was sitting in that Ferrari right now, JBL.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's every race that goes by, I think, is kind of cementing the right decision in his mind. Although I would imagine if, you know, the results in the simulator over the winter had been more felicitous, let's say, then you wouldn't have made that move. I think Phil sort of touched upon the temperature aspect, but I think ultimately that the cars were just really, really poor on the hard tyre overall, and that's something Hamilton sort of spoke about. He wished he'd had more sets of mediums. He was sort of battling a little bit of damage. He had a little bit of contact with Charles Leclerc early on in the race, which cost him a little bit of time. But when you look at his stints compared to George Russell on the medium tyre towards the end, his stint was a lot quicker. So he had pace in reserve. It was just, I think the damage was done very, very early on. Really, really struggled on those hard tyres, particularly relative to Russell. Russell was sort of like a little bit more at ease with them. Hamilton said, oh, shall we swap? Which I thought was a nice little bit of team play. But that kind of says where Mercedes is. If they were challenging for race wins or podiums, he'd never have made that call on the radio. Fighting over 7th, 8th and 9th doesn't seem to interest him at all, which, you know, let's be honest, is fair given his career. It's just not been a particularly good day. I think they're still sort of relatively optimistic that they made breakthroughs throughout the Suzuka weekend, hugely improved over last year in the opening sector in particular. It's just the case that they're still getting to grips with a very, very different car and they don't really know what it does. You only get kind of 3 days of testing before a season to learn an entirely new car, and you're finding new bits about it every weekend. So it does need a little bit more time to kind of understand. I don't think it's all doom and gloom right now. It's just a case of they've been working to a sort of very different hymn sheet over the last couple of years compared to now, and that's going to take time to overcome.
Yeah, talking about the hard tyre, it was a C1, it's the hardest of the hard tyres, isn't it? And it didn't go to plan. They didn't start on the hard tyre, they started on the mediums, but after a very, very early red flag, they opted to move on to the hard tyre, both him and George, so a change of strategy. But let's talk about the red flag then. This is involving a driver who, if there's any driver who needs a bit of luck or who needs something to go his way, it's Daniel Ricciardo, isn't it? I mean, Daniel Ricciardo involved in a turn two incident with Alex Albon. Who do you apportion blame to, or was it just one of those racing incident move on, JBL?
I think it will probably be fair to say, and this does sound very fence city, but I think it's racing incident with a hint of blame on Ricciardo's shoulders. I think you can't give apportion any blame to Albon in it, really. He'd seen Ricciardo coming out of turn two very, very slowly, wanted to pounce on it, and quite rightly, and he thought he could get the move done into turn three. Ricciardo was looking to his left because he kind of had sensed that perhaps Lance Stroll was coming down that side. He zoomed over to the racing line and just hadn't seen Albon at all, and that was it. And I think it was fair to give it as a racing incident, but I do think that Ricciardo probably could have avoided the incident by looking in the other mirror.
Wow.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he was just looking in his left mirror, wasn't he? He wasn't, you know, expecting anybody up the outside, which you could understand, but you still want to check probably before you close the door there. But I think actually the stewards put it well. They said that if this hadn't been a first lap accident, we would have looked at this differently, suggesting that they probably would have pinged Ricciardo for it. But because it was a first lap crash and they're a lot more lenient than those, they decided to let it go. And I think that's probably the right decision this time.
Yeah, I mean, it was a racing incident, but Daniel Ricciardo needs to put some different socks on or something, because the ones he's got are just not working for him. He needs to, I don't know, get a different bed and wake up on the other side of it or something. He's going to be trying everything over the next couple of weeks, isn't he? Across the garage, it doesn't help, though, that he's having always this luck, should we say. I mean, it's not always bad luck, but across the garage, his teammate Yuki Tsunoda is just doing it, isn't he? He scored Japan's first point at a home Grand Prix since Kamui Kobayashi back in 2012, when he got that amazing podium. Just how good a drive was it for Yuki Tsunoda, Phil?
Yeah, it was a great drive. It's very gritty, no mistakes, very fast. And, you know, on a weekend where there would have been a lot of pressure on him, not just for what might happen or might not happen for him in his career next year, but also just in front of his home fans in Japan, there was no hint of him feeling any sort of pressure, which is impressive. And obviously the pit stop that he thanked the team for, when he had this whole gaggle of cars come in and he came out first, that helped him a lot. But yeah, he was very good. And again, is he going to be considered for Red Bull? I doubt it, especially not if Christian Horner is going to be making those calls himself. But he does what he has to do. He can't do much more.
He can't do much more. He can't do much more, JBL. And that's the thing, you know, what does he have to do to be looking at the best seats in the party? If that's a saying, we're going to call it a saying from now on.
The best seat at the party. Well, I think he just needs to keep doing what he's doing, because ultimately we're in a situation where these back five teams can't score unless one of the top five teams has a real off day. Today that was Stroll just being a bit useless. So Tsunoda made the absolute most of that. His moves at turn six around the outside, one of them on Hülkenberg in particular, was stunning. I thought it was, you know, you have a situation where you're in front of your home fans. I imagine there's a huge amount of pressure to perform. And he just goes and pulls that move off. And he was brave. Even though the team sort of gave him a huge leg up with that stop, the fact that, you know, he put it on the marks perfectly, got out the pits rapidly without any real delay. It was just like clockwork. It was a huge, huge sort of marker in his race, and that made the passes possible. I thought it was just a really, really good day. And he's had a really good start to the season. Absolutely blown Ricciardo away. Ricciardo, the guy that was saying, ah, oh, you know, he'll come in and replace Perez. That's looking less likely by the day. But I don't know how. If I was at Red Bull, I would kind of consider Tsunoda, surely. But he just doesn't seem to. Horner doesn't seem to rate him. Helmut Marko sort of seems relatively hot and cold. He's always happy to praise Tsunoda when he's done a good job, but equally, if he's had a slightly less good day, he does tend to stick the boot in. So you don't really know where he stands. I think, honestly, the best opportunity for him would be when Aston Martin links up with Honda. Honda's batted for him for a very long time, and if he keeps producing the goods, then he might have a shot there. If they do eventually get rid of Stroll, you know, something like, let's say if Sainz goes there or somebody of that caliber alongside Tsunoda, that'd be a really compelling driver lineup. But I'd like to see him in a Red Bull. I'd like to see him, give him a chance.
Yeah, and doing it, you know, you're a Japanese driver, you're doing it at Suzuka, a Honda track, and you've got a V-Carb and Red Bull and all the Honda links there. So it's quite nice, isn't it? And if you want people to take notice, that's one way to do it. I just want to touch on the Yuki thing, because he finished over 40 seconds behind Hamilton's Mercedes and a lap off of Max. So is it, do you think, a bad thing that we're seeing such a big disparity between the top five teams and the rest, JBL?
Yeah, honestly, it's not great. It's not, when you go into a race weekend and you know probably 90% of the score, who the scorers are going to be, it's not a particularly sort of compelling reason to watch. And this is something I did put to the drivers in Australia, actually. I was like, well, you know that you're going to go into a situation where somebody has to retire or Stroll has to have an off day for you to score. How do you stay motivated? And Valtteri Bottas suggested maybe bringing down the points to P12 or something might spice it up a little bit, because there's not really much glory fighting for 12th at the moment. But the thing is, it might change next year, and that gap might be closed up. It is, I think, artificially large because Alpine has just started the season in such a bad way. But it's not great. It's not a particularly good situation for the fans of those teams as well. You know, you like to have a little bit of variance and variety in results and just knowing who the top five teams are going to be every weekend. It's just not particularly interesting. But hopefully, you know, hopefully that will change. It's, you know, F1's pretty dynamic when it needs to be.
Formula One's pretty good at reinventing itself, JBL. It needs to do something to maybe appeal to the wider fan. I think those of us that will watch it no matter what, they've got us, haven't they? But those others that are maybe sort of floating fans have got to find some interest elsewhere. Phil, let's move this conversation slightly on, though, to the tyre choices that were available. And that was something that Formula One has done in the Japanese Grand Prix. It gave us a bit of
opportunity to see teams using alternative strategies as opposed to the same strategy. So what are your thoughts on the soft tyre and the approach that happened here in Japan?
Well, I think it just helps that it was a little bit cooler than it was in September last year. So automatically the softest compounds become a bit more viable for the race. So that's something you can't really control necessarily. And it remains to be seen if you can replicate this sort of three tires being a good option for the race at other sort of more demanding circuits. But obviously, you know, if you have three compounds that can all be used, then you've got way more strategic options. And that means you're going to see a better race by definition. You're going to see people transit on different strategies, one stop, two stop, people gambling on the stint on softs and see what happens. So, you know, the more variety you get there, the better. And you know, it's completely deadly when you have like an easy one stop, because that means that there's clearly one strategy that's the best, and everybody will be on that, and then you just see nothing. So, yes, it wasn't for the lead today, but we did see some good battles, and the fact that the tires were all usable were a massive part in that. So yeah, that's good. Are we going to see it a lot more? Probably not in the likes of the likes of Miami, but maybe in China, where there's a new asphalt, we have some unknowns. So maybe it's possible there as well, where it's also going to be cold.
Yeah, it's exciting that we got China coming up now, first time since 2019. Did you both enjoy what you saw in the Japanese Grand Prix, JBO? I don't want you to give it a rating out of 10 or anything like that, but did you enjoy it? Because it was one of those races that it's a bit like a IndyCar race where you don't quite know what's going to happen till the end, till everyone's sorted out all the pit stops and you know what everyone's on. It was intriguing, at least. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I'd subscribe to that. Obviously, beyond the top two, it was pretty sort of clear cut. But behind that, it was, everybody, people cycle out at different times. The undercut was very, very powerful, but it couldn't necessarily be maintained throughout the race. So let's say when Norris first stopped, he'd cycled out in kind of a net third, but then his tyre started to go and you had the Ferraris coming up behind him, you had Leclerc out front extending his stint as well, so that bought him the pit stop basically, and then Norris dropped to fifth. So it was really, really interesting to see how everybody tackled it differently. As Phil said, the latitude for different strategies was really something that made the race. I did enjoy it. It was quite early in the morning for me to kind of get my head around, which I think, maybe a good little bit of a brain teaser, but yeah, I think I did, to be honest with you.
Yeah, same here. I'll never praise a race where there's zero jeopardy for the win or even the top two, so I'll never give it high marks, but the strategies did ensure that there was always something to watch first yet. The Norris undercut, was that going to work out? That kind of got negated by him pitting alongside Leclerc, and then there were signs delaying his final stop and then marching through the order at the end. So there was always something to watch. So the fact that the battle behind Red Bull is so close is sort of a saving grace. But yeah, it will never be a classic race if there's no doubt about the identity of the winner for me.
Not a classic, but certainly it was worth getting up for. There you go, JBL. I think I summarized the thought process just there. Now, moving slightly away from this, but kind of linking into the Japanese Grand Prix, just heading into the weekend, it was announced that the chief designer, that's David Sanchez at McLaren, or formerly of McLaren, because he's now leaving, it was announced he's leaving after just 3 months. He was brought in January, wasn't it? Which is a bit strange. Both parties claim the role for David wasn't what either of them were anticipating. So what the heck has happened internally at McLaren, Phil?
Well, it's hard to say, without question, but I think the main thing is that you have to keep in mind that David Sanchez signed up well over a year ago from Ferrari. So I think the deal was done, please correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was February last year. So it's over 12 months, 14 months ago. So obviously since then, a lot has changed. McLaren have had this reorganization that Sanchez was you know, cherry picked to be a part of with the triple technical director structure. But then, you know, things move on. You know, they worked without Sanchez for a year. And, you know, as Andrea Stella took over, I'm sure he must have noticed how, you know, how it seems progressing. And then once Sanchez and Rob Marshall actually started in January, maybe some of what was agreed 14 months ago has slightly shifted in terms of where they fit in exactly. And you know, not just that, but also what's your responsibility and what isn't your responsibility. And it's perfectly possible for someone like Sanchez to say, like, actually, this isn't quite what I signed up for. It isn't quite my strength to be in this sort of leadership position or whatever it may be. We don't know. So it's unusual for him to like depart after 3 months. It's hard to say, really. But you can see that if it's really a very different structure to the way he's used to working, that maybe he's noticed that actually this isn't really working for me or for the team.
And you have to say well done to them if that is the case. It's not working out. Let's just pull the plug on it before it gets any further along the process. We're looking ahead at the Chinese Grand Prix, the first time since 2019. Very quickly, both of you, what are you looking forward to? That's interesting. English is my first language. How about that? What are you both looking forward to the most, JBL?
Well, I think, and having sort of just sort of have a brief overview of what conditions to expect. And as Phil has already said, it is going to be relatively cold at this time of year. New asphalt as well. So the expected thing is there's going to be quite a lot of graining, like there was in Australia. So that's something that if Red Bull still hasn't got on top of it, that could bring Ferrari back into it. That could bring, you know, a couple of other teams sort of into the mix so they can get their head around it. And it's because it's a circuit we haven't been to since 2019. Data for it is very, very outdated. We've got nothing on it for these 2022 cars, and it's going to be a sprint weekend. So everybody's got to hope that there is not a single blemish in practice, because any single red flag, even for 5 minutes, that's going to throw so much data out of the window. So we could have a real topsy-turvy weekend. If one top team doesn't, you know, hit it quite right, then it could be really, really unpredictable. It might not be, but, you know, I like to live in hope.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's also obviously a different sprint format this year. So teams will have longer before Parc Fermé, or they have like a second Parc Fermé for, you know, for sprint and then for qualifying for the race. So it'll be interesting to see how they deal with that. As you say, FP1 is going to be key, so you can't afford any sort of mistakes, not just like physical mistakes, but also in terms of your setup direction. You just don't have any time to backtrack or to try to do something different. So you have to be on it straight away, which could introduce some jeopardy. You could also argue that, well, the best teams are more likely to get their ducks in a row than the others, right? Because they have the best resources. Also possible, but still there is a bit of extra variance maybe that's being introduced. So as much as I'm not really a fan of sprints in general, I think the lack of practice, you know, it can introduce something new. So we've seen that on a few occasions over the past couple of years that some teams just got it wrong and then they couldn't really recover from that. And then, yeah, as JBL said, it's not only have we not been there for 5 years, but it's also a new tarmac. So that's, yeah, it's really... a step into the unknown for a lot of teams. But yeah, you would have to say that if it is a race where graining is a big issue, then if you look at Australia as well, you would back Ferrari to do better than they do on sort of the high thermal degradation races like here and like Bahrain. So maybe Ferrari will fancy their chances, actually.
Well, there you go. Maybe, but would it be Charles Leclerc or will it be Carlos Sainz that fancies his chances even more? Gents, thank you so much. That about wraps it up for our meandering review of the Japanese Grand Prix. We didn't get to any cherry blossom or anything like that. I know JBL was so disappointed he didn't get to witness the cherry blossom, but I don't want to open that particular wound right now. That's for another day. Remember, if you liked what you heard on this podcast, don't forget you can hit that follow button to stay in the loop for all of our 2024 coverage of F1, as well as our BTCC Top 10 series and Driven to Succeed, featuring the best young up-and-coming talent in motorsport. So we'll be back next week with a preview when Formula One returns to Shanghai and the first Chinese Grand Prix since 2019. But until then, thanks so much for listening.
Sports Social Podcast Network.